Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hu Jintao's visit last week put the spotlight again on China and its rise. But there is another power rising in the East, surging into the global economy, India, where new opportunities and ambitions are rubbing up against very old ways, where young Indians put aside ancient texts for self-help books, where young women explain in divorce court that they deserve better, and now expect it. This hour on Point, India's rise and what it means for life inside India today. Joining me now in the studio is Anand Giridharadas. He grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, to parents who had come to America from Mumbai, India. After college, he joined the consulting firm McKinsey & Co. in Mumbai, where he worked for a year and a half. He went on to become bureau chief for the New York Times and International Herald Tribune in Mumbai, where he stayed for another 4.5 years. Now he's been back in the USA a bit, a columnist for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online, and a doctoral candidate in political philosophy at Harvard. His new book is India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Anand Giridharadas, thank you very much for being with us again. Good to have you back.
It's wonderful to be here, this time in the studio.
Yeah, it's just terrific. We've loved your story from the beginning. Indian American, first generation parents, goes back to India, experiences it with eyes that are both quite knowing, but also communicate very effectively to an American audience. It's one of our privileges as Americans to have people like you in our ranks. I found myself wondering, though, knowing we were going to be talking, wondering last week when that other Asian power representative, Hu Jintao, was in town representing China, what you were thinking about that visit and his representation of China in this country, America's response to Hu Jintao and China in that meeting.
I was very struck by the feeling that we continue in this country to misapprehend what's going on with 2.5 billion people in India and China engage in this extraordinary drama of remaking their countries.
Misapprehend? I mean, people feel like they know what's going on. They're sending us all kinds of stuff. We're buying it at Walmart.
And that's the extent of it. And if you looked at the coverage when President Hu was here, there was all of this coverage about how they're wrecking our economy, which is actually a much more complicated relationship. And there, you know, as soon as he arrived, it was kind of, what is his view on currency? What's his view on Iran? What's his view on North Korea? We reduce the extraordinary, and of course, human rights. Mm-hmm. We reduce the extraordinary complex drama of what it takes to modernize such a big country so much more quickly than the West was modernized. And I think sometimes we need to have a lot more empathy for what both China and India are going through as they seek to kind of untether themselves from deep traditions, a feudal past, and remake themselves as modern, humane, just nations.
Are China and India going through the same thing?
It's funny, you know, they're often, so often contrasted, and there's a lot of reason to contrast them. I think the most important differences are obviously the democracy authoritarianism thing. And a lot of American discourse kind of gets stuck on that.
India famously with the democracy, China famously with the Communist Party.
That's right. And I think a lot of American discourse gets stuck on that difference. There are other important differences. I think probably even more important at a human level is the different attitudes they have towards the past. The Indian attitude tends to be, let's embrace modernity, but always fold it into the traditional. If anything, the modernity is always kind of on the defensive in India, and the traditional always has the upper hand. In China, there has been an attitude of wiping out large pieces of the past and welcoming the future.
Though now they're establishing Confucius Institutes all over the world
now
to teach Chinese.
There's a recognition, and I spent a lot of time with people in China last year talking about this. There's a recognition that they've gone too far in wiping out the past, and they're trying to bring it back. But I have found, when I've spent time in both countries, an extraordinary similarity if you go beneath the kind of layers of what government system they have and even these attitudes to the past. There's a drama of moving hundreds of millions of people in two or three generations from the countryside to the city. There's a drama of how do you take societies where privilege was inherited and controlled by those inheritances and move to a meritocratic society where people get ahead based on what they do rather than who they are. There's an extraordinary drama of getting people to develop a civic idea. Philanthropists are trying to figure out how do you get people in societies that have traditionally given to their family alone to give to give anonymously to the community. So I've been struck by actually how similar a lot of the conversations are in both countries about what needs to be done.
You described in the context of looking at that drama these two countries, China and India, headed toward development. Raising up those hundreds of millions, as you say, but also headed toward a future of more justice. I think part of the focus in the U.S. on human rights, certainly, but some of the apprehension as well with the rise in economic power is on that latter point, how that's defined, what that means. I mean, what's your level of confidence for China, for India for that matter, that that's the destination?
I think in a way, there's a kind of reason for hope and a reason to worry. The reason for hope is the biggest thing that has held people down, if I just talk about India for a moment, is a simple lack of opportunity. You can attribute it to any number of other things, but people have not had the means to buy themselves out of oppressions. They've been vulnerable to other people, needing the landlord's weekly wages, etc. And so to the extent that the market is coming in and empowering people financially, that's a big wave of empowerment that happens. However, what makes me worry is the view in India, and I think there's probably the same phenomenon in China, although I know it less well, that this market force alone will solve everything. In a way, there's a misreading of the American experience that you find in a lot of developing countries, where people look at America, this great free market society, and kind of assume that America actually did nothing else besides the free market, whereas in fact America's had a very active government and done all kinds of extraordinary things to lay the platform. So to the extent that a lot of dignity comes from having really good courts and really good collective systems and effective ways of kind of redistributing land when people need to be moved off it for industry, I think there's a lot less attention in India to the kind of other parts of justice that don't come with financial empowerment alone.
Take us back to your story, because it helps inform everything we'll hear in this hour. Your mom and dad coming from India to Cleveland, ultimately. You growing up there, and then ultimately, after college, headed back to India. I don't recall if it was your first time. I guess not, but to actually spend 5-6 years there. What brought them to the States? Did they think you'd ever end up going back as a 20-something fresh graduate from college to India when they were raising you as a boy?
It would have been unimaginable. What brought it was my father who made the decision and my mother who went with him. I once asked him what motivated. He was a young 20-something student and then a young trainee and management trainee. And he had worked very hard to get where he'd gotten. And
that is in the United States.
No, this is, I'm saying still in India.
Oh, already in India, okay.
Still in India. He'd worked very hard as a young student, and now he's here in the workforce. And he said he looked at his boss as a socialist India, you need a kind of permit to produce anything.
What, the early 1970s?
Exactly. And he looked at his bosses 20 years ahead of him in line, he told me once, and he concluded very simply that he didn't want to spend 20 years becoming them. And that was a very simple decision, actually. And, you know, he had not been raised to be kind of deeply introspective and kind of ponder this for, you know, he had some friends going to applying to Harvard Business School, and he just thought, why not?
Well, that in itself must have set him apart. I mean, most Indians obviously were sort of marching in the train of behind their bosses. He didn't. They came to the States, sitting in Cleveland. Did they grow up telling you, you know, Anand, when you get out of college, you can race back to India and spend 5 or 6 years there?
No, in a way, and they never said the opposite either, but it was, in a way, the premise of our entire life, the premise of the house we had, the premise of the yard we played in, the premise of the stories that we were told had migration stringing through all of them. Our story began with leaving India and coming to America. There was no escaping that story, and it was as if our story kind of had this thrust behind it, and you couldn't imagine kind of pivoting around and going the other way.
Why did you?
You know, when I was a child, I think there were two things. One, personally, no one wants to be different as a kid. And my Americanness made me the same as everybody else. Mm-hmm. My Indianness made me unbearably different. And so that was something to minimize in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it was not only that. I think that was a time in the world when India was a very different place. It did not have the recognition, and people were not saying wonderful things about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And a child picks that up. Mm-hmm. They were saying quite terrible things. And
parents used to say, you know, finish your dinner. There are children starving in India.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so you're not clamoring to be from a place like mm-hmm. that when you're 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think more than that, the older I got, it was not just a simple revulsion. It was something much deeper, which was the boundlessness and sense of possibility that I loved in this country seemed to vanish when I would visit India as a child. People seemed to be living these very replicated lives, and it sometimes seemed to me that almost nothing was possible there.
And yet you went back. We're going to hear a lot about that and about India. Anand Giridharadas' new book is India Calling. Tell us quickly about the music we're hearing behind us right here.
This is one of my favorite Indian artists, Ravi Shergill, who's a Punjabi artist. I'm half Punjabi by ethnicity, and he's kind of taking old folk music and modernizing it.
A song about justice.
Yeah.
Right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. After Hu Jintao's visit from China, we're talking this hour about the other Asian giant, India, with Anand Giridharadas. Sorry, Anand. His new book is India Calling, an intimate portrait of a nation's remaking. Grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, went back, spent 5 or 6 years in his 20s, just after college, in India, and brings us a lot of the story of what's really going on there. I want to go back to what you said about tradition and history, maybe holding a little greater leverage in India than in China. That's so much of that is woven through your book. And if I may, let me come to that through a web comment we have here from Shiva, who's listening. I'm afraid this is just another elitist portrayal, Shiva writes. He writes, come to our little towns and villages and live with us. You'll find the other side of this coin. We have television, cell phones, and whatnot, but we still pay additional taxes, bribes, to get our birth certificate, death certificate, marriage certificate, passport, caste certificate, infinite list. He says millions come out of college every year, but as substandard assembly line products of for-profit colleges run by retired politicians. Shiva says, what sort of nation rebuilding is this? I agree that our ancient demanding culture is history, and so are our values and hopes. There's a lot to unpack there, and it sort of lines up with the themes of your book in some ways. Take it on.
You know, I think that it's unfortunate to get into calling different portrayals elitist and not elitist, so let me set that aside and just say I hear this a lot, and I think it reflects an anxiety that I totally understand. I have gone and lived in the villages. I have gone mm-hmm. and lived in small towns.
You write about them in great detail.
Mm-hmm. In those areas. Mm-hmm. And besides the language, the commenter is exactly right, that there are two narratives in modern India, and both are happening at the same time, and we are still waiting to see what's going to win. One narrative is about the extraordinary things that private dynamism can do, whether it's what companies do or more than that, what private individuals with ambition and pride and an ability to kind of move forward on their own steam can achieve. And there are extraordinary stories of self-making happening even in those villages, even in those small towns. And I don't need to kind of we can talk about those particular stories in depth, but that is certainly happening, and you can find almost no part of India where you don't see those kind of ruptures.
But there are ruptures.
There are ruptures.
In a fabric, not the
exactly.
fabric.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think what the commenter is getting at, which is also true, mm-hmm. is where private dynamism keeps bumping up in India against collective systems, public systems. right? So where you have things in India that require simply an individual to be ambitious or a company to be ambitious, mm-hmm. not need anybody, push forward and get it done, those things tend to be working very well in India. The mobile phone market in India as an example, it's one of the best in the world, much better than my AT&T service in this mm-hmm. country. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to things that require the private ambitions and dynamisms of multiple people, millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, to be reconciled. When you want land for a car factory and mm-hmm. I want to keep my land mm-hmm. because I'm a villager, our ambitions clash. Then what happens? Who decides? How is it reconciled? How durable is the decision? Those are the kinds of things like getting a birth certificate and a caste certificate that require public collective systems. And there, India is almost entirely still the old India. And one of the big questions is, can private dynamism solve a lot of these problems? I actually find in India a lot of belief that it can, and I disagree with that. I actually think India needs to wake up to the reality that private dynamism is amazing and it will liberate India from a lot of the past, but that it'll only get you so far.
Those are social level clashes that you're talking about, but you also describe in great and intimate detail the kind of internal clashes individual Indians can feel in this environment of change between the traditions you described and their demands and this new ethos. Give us some sense of what's playing out there, perhaps, you know, in Indians that we may be meeting in the universities or in business or just on the telephone.
You see this in a way, you put it very well, that we tend to think about modernity and tradition and that clash as being kind of between people, but it's really within people. Mm-hmm. It's a series of Indians, one by one, making choices about, do I live this way or do I live that way? And it's the aggregation of those millions of choices that make a country modern over time. You see this very clearly in the domain of love and marriage. Obviously, as even anyone with a very cursory knowledge of India knows, India had arranged marriage traditionally and a very kind of pragmatic understanding of the purpose of marriage and love as a kind of lubricant of arranged marriages that suited family interests. Mm-hmm. That is slowly, and I emphasize slowly, giving way to a kind of Romeo and Juliet revolution, mm-hmm. where the love matters more than the pragmatics, where it's really about two-ness and two people finding what they can find and not family.
As they like, or still in the main within the caste structure and all the rest?
No, I mean, well, the idea that's pushing in is that love matters more than anything else. But in India, where the old always has the upper hand, just because that idea is pushing in doesn't mean every other idea disappears from the scene.
Far from it. I mean, doesn't the old still overwhelmingly hold sway? I'm not sure, but aren't the papers still full of those marriage ads?
Absolutely.
Looking for someone of a certain caste, even
exactly.
a certain skin tone down to the finest, you know, nuance?
Exactly. So the way I would say it is, a majority of people still do this mostly in the traditional way. Mm-hmm. But even the people who are doing it in the new way, the minority of mm-hmm. people who are starting mm-hmm. to get a different idea, they too are quite faithful to tradition alongside their modernity. And so I write in the book about people who might, in the, you know, modern upper middle class people in Delhi and Bombay who might pursue all of these different approaches at once. They may be drinking and smoking and hooking up with people in the kind of Western 20-something way, mm-hmm. and then going home on Saturday morning and sitting with their parents and looking through matrimonial advertisements online and kind of shortlisting people, mm-hmm. and allowing their grandmother, meanwhile, to be tapping into family networks to see if anything can be done that way. And they may be regular cocaine users and comfortable with arranged marriage, and all these things are true to them.
At the same time, take us even deeper. There, we're talking about it through the prism of marriage, arranged marriage. People know that well. But there, you take us to another level here. You describe Gandhi and Nehru seeing, as you put it, a wholeness in India as they pushed for independence from the British that many Indians did not see for or in themselves. And to take that further, you write about Gandhi, the poet Rabindranath Tagore, Swami Vivekananda, you know, big names in India, saying they all spoke of a link between a society strong on the outside and a society of strong and whole selves, suggesting that those whole, strong and whole selves were not a fact, or that that's something that's still growing.
I think one of the things that all of those people you mentioned understood when they were writing earlier in the last century was that the kind of independence that they were all dreaming of for India as a country mm-hmm. was linked to another kind of independence, which was an independence of one being at a time.
Do they really want that, or is that in a permanent conflict with the traditional Indian sense of community?
I think family. That is, but these people that I'm mm-hmm. talking about yes. were all actually quite irreverent thinkers
yes.
within the Indian context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So none of them were simple kind of describers of India as it was. They were all
aspirational
irreverent. And utopians about mm-hmm. what India could be. And I think all of them, in different ways, of course, they all, of course, had a sense of community. But I think in different ways, they all emphasized the idea of the self as a robust thing that needed to be cultivated. And they understood that independence was independence for the nation and independence for the individual. One of the things, the conclusions that I come to in this book is India achieved that collective independence very successfully in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
What it did not achieve then was an independence of the soul for so many individuals.
For individuals. Mm.
Independence from the constraints of family, the constraints of bureaucracy, the constraints of bad economics, the constraints of class. And what I think is happening now in India is a kind of second independence, very slow, trickling very slowly down through the society, but an independence of private individuals able to make their destiny
on
their own terms.
Is that an American-raised, Indian-American speaking there? Is that an aspiration that Indians universally share, or is that seen as a collapse of values, selfishness, Western-style invasion?
This falls entirely along age lines. Mm-hmm. The young rich and the young poor speak in much more similar language than the old rich and the young rich. I've been pretty deep into the villages, pretty deep into the small towns, and hear young people with almost nothing speak in a language of self-making and possibility. They now see this kind of second independence as being an entitlement of not just people with means, but of everybody who lives.
Anand Giridharadas is with us. His new book is India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. And we barely come to the stories yet. We will, but I want to get our callers in here. Namish is calling from Boston. Hi, Namish. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I really like your show and listen to you daily.
Oh, wonderful.
I just want to say that I've grew up in India most of my life. I had schooling in India and also part of college in India.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to England for 3 years to do my master's. And then after that, I came to America.
Okay, great.
So what I want to talk about is the Indian society has changed drastically in the last 10 to 12 years, also in the public mentality, which has become so modern. And your guest was talking about his father, reason for his father to coming to U.S.
Yes.
So it's like I also had the same reason that I came to U.S. besides going to England as well, because the opportunities that I had in 4 years in U.S. Was not possible in England as well. So I mean, I would like to say that U.S. is still the land of opportunity, and Indians see it that way, though.
That's very interesting in itself, Namish. I appreciate your call. Did you find that, Anand, in India, people still looking to the U.S. or outside of India? Or, I mean, Namish has been sort of on the global path for a while now. Back home, are people just as happy to dive into opportunity there?
You know, I think what's happening now, people often ask me, does this mean that nobody's emigrating to America anymore? Of course it does not mean that. You have a country of more than a billion people.
Mm-hmm.
The line outside the consulates is still long everywhere in India to get mm-hmm. a visa to come mm-hmm. here. It's rather the change is the number of people who could have also been in those lines who choose to stay back, particularly educated elites. So if you take institutions like the Indian Institute of Management, Indian Institute of Technology, these were places that used to educate large numbers of people, including my father, and then they would all be gone, and they'd be here. A significant proportion of those people now stay in India because they see opportunity. Now, in a country of a billion people, if they don't go, there's going to be plenty of other people who are willing to go. So it's not a reversal of the flow, but the flow is now becoming a two-way flow, and there are plenty of people who feel they don't need to leave to reinvent themselves. That's the change.
There's opportunity there. There's ambition. There's expectation. I wish you'd give us a little sense of the divorce court where you spent some time watching Indian couples trying to sort of work out this new scheme of ambitions and expectations and how they may clash with what they've got and what they do with those clashes. Give us a sense of what you saw there.
I went to spend a week in a divorce court in Bombay, and the reason was, you know, everyone is talking in India about the new idea of love and love marriage pushing into the old arranged marriage. One of the things that was kind of less explored was what happens 5-10 years down the road with this trend. What are the forerunners of this trend encountering? And one of the surprising answers when people start to fall in love instead of just marry for family reasons is actually these marriages are not very durable, at least not as durable as the old marriages. And the reason is partly because now women have a lot more freedom. And another part of the reason is when people get married in the old way for family, there are a lot of supports to a marriage like that. There are a lot of people pulling for you. Perhaps you're living in a big traditional household, 20 people around. You get in a little fight. There are a lot of people there to do household shuttle diplomacy.
Many threads.
And when you get married in the new way, what I found in the divorce court, I actually asked if I could interview couples. And this being India, where everything's kind of flexible and people are very generous, like 5 or 6 divorcing couples agreed to have joint interviews
with me. Yeah.
And so I sat there and asked them to reconstruct what happened. And the story was always that they were young, fell in love, ignored the considerations of family, et cetera, married each other for each other, and then woke up one day and realized that everything was gambled on the sentiments that would crackle between them. And if anything happened to that crackling, suddenly there was nothing else. And it was those kinds of things that made me kind of complicate my simple American vision of saying love marriage is better, arranged marriage is kind of traditional and stupid.
What were the tensions that would get into the middle, you know, mess up the crackle? What pushed them apart?
It was different things, actually. You know, in one case, there was a young woman who was a kind of staff trainer for an Indian mobile phone company and kind of a good job, and she was a Brahmin. And she married
high caste,
and she married a what her family called a Chinese vala, which is a guy who sold Chinese food from a street stall.
Not high caste,
not high income. Mm-hmm. You know, selling food on the street, what many Indians would consider somewhat degrading work.
So this had to really be a big romance to get that off the ground in the first place.
And exactly, and like many young people in the new India, she flipped the interpretation of this. And her grandmother would have said, we're from different backgrounds. This is proof that this won't work. Her interpretation was, this cannot work by any conventional logic. So the fact that we still love each other suggests how overpowering our love is. The fact that the context doesn't, this does not make sense. Therefore, it is love. And so they got married. And as soon as they did, you know, things happen. And it's not very different than things that happen anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, his work started to suffer. You know, she got pregnant at the time that he lost his job, et cetera, et cetera. The normal kind of battering that any couple has. But they were not raised for that kind of total dependence on another person. And the love and support and care that Indians traditionally would have received from 12 different people were now entirely waged on one person. And sometimes it's more than one person can give.
We're getting the inside story of India this hour. Anand Giridharadas is with us. His new book is India Calling. Here's the theme from the 2010 Bollywood political thriller Rajneeti. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about India with a young Indian American raised in Cleveland who went back in his 20s, spent 5 or 6 years there, brought back a wonderful, intimate account, a real education for Americans, kind of a mirror held up by a sort of son of India once removed back in his family's home country. Anand Girdardas is with me. His new book is India Calling, an intimate portrait of a nation's remaking. You can join the conversation. Do you know India? Where is it headed? Do India's ambitions and its realities at home match up? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Let's get a call from Augusta, Georgia, and Matt. Hi, Matt. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
The question I had, or maybe it was more of a comment, was as we look around and see these countries emerging, countries like China and India, India doesn't really make me feel that uncomfortable. I don't know if that's if I'm speaking from fact or from feeling, but it seems like we do have a lot of common ground. There's not a lot of ideological rifts between, not necessarily the people, but between the governments. And I wanted to know if that was something that can be worked on in the future.
What, you see the sort of benevolent Asian giant standing up here, Matt?
Yeah, exactly. Because we hear China growing and developing, and for most of us, it's not that comfortable, whether it's because of the government or rhetoric from their media or just uncomfortableness with China. Even though we know a lot about China, or at least we seem to, we just don't seem to connect. But with India, there just seems to be a little more ease with them and their goals as well. So I just want to know, you know, is it just how I feel, or is there actually some fact behind it?
Yeah, Matt, I'm glad you raise it. What do you say, Anand? The benevolent giant in India, and that's comfort factor. You know, China a little more strident on the nationalism and with the Communist Party background. What about Americans look at India and say, oh, yeah, no problem, this is great?
It's very interesting. I think in a way, if I understand the sentiment behind what Matt is feeling and many people are feeling, is that India and China both pose a kind of economic threat, a threat of competitiveness. But India does not pose a systemic challenge to the consensus of Western liberal democracy over the last 500 years. There's been a system that has dominated since kind of the end of medieval Europe. And we've all come to believe in the system. And India, for all of the power and force behind it, believes in the same system, more or less. You have elections every so often. You have constitutional rights. You have courts that people can petition. You have an open free press. So all of this economic dynamism is married in the Indian case to a system that's very much like our system.
You describe lots of systemic injustice in India even now, though, that's tolerated or even part of
India. But those are, in a way, failures of the functioning of a system that is very similar to our system. Mm-hmm, that doesn't mean the system's executed perfectly. Mm-hmm. But India does not present an idea to the world about how humans should be governed that is fundamentally different from the existing American and Western idea. China does. And that's what's so interesting and important about these two countries rising side by side. In some ways, it's a similar story of the kind of creation of a majority urban, majority middle class world that both of them are kind of pushing us into. And socially, what's happening in both countries is very similar. But China is the first major, large scale, systemic challenge to the consensus on
the
Western liberal democracy
more
being the best system in the world. Because what they've done is remarkable enough to make us wonder whether our system is, for all cases, truly better.
Matt, thanks for your call. Here's another from Diane in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Diane. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
I spent a lot of time in India between 1997 and 2002 with two different employers doing startups in India.
Okay.
What I found was...
You know a lot, then.
I'm sorry?
You know a lot, then, Diane.
Yeah. And during that period of time, I worked with the people from IIT and the people who had law degrees and so on, and many of whom had spent a couple of years in the United States or in Britain, and who had everything going for them and were very strong in entrepreneurial spirit and so on.
So these were top-tier technologists, entrepreneurs, Indian Institute of Technology, top of the charts.
Exactly. And at the same time, I witnessed the other end of the spectrum. For example, one of the companies I was working with was on the 7th floor of what was going to be a 10th floor building, and they were already occupying the 7th floor, and the other upper floors were still being constructed, and the women carrying infants on their hips and carrying cement and grout up to the higher floors by steps.
On their heads, in baskets, no doubt.
On their heads, yeah, which was not even on baskets, on trowels, more or less.
Wow.
But anyway, the point is that that was evident, and the people sitting by the side of the road with little hammers and chisels breaking up rock and so on. And what I'm asking your speaker is whether how are the vast majority of people who are very poor working in manual labor in the cities, having babies on their hips, who they put down on the shawl on the ground when they need a nap.
Yeah.
How are they ever going to get lifted up? And is this something that only benefits? How does this trickle down, if you want to use that cliched expression, help the people who are earning $1.50 a day, and all of the kids who are still begging in the streets, and the very, very poor?
Diane, it's a great question, and I'll put it straight to Anand. I mean, is it possible that you'd have, I don't know, 500 million Indians who would become part of the global system and, with its caste history, leave 500 million behind, as Diane
did? I think that is possible, and it's very worrying, and there are no easy answers. I think a few statistics. India has more poor people today than sub-Saharan Africa. So you think of all the kind of fundraisers and brigades that go to Africa and worry about Africa. If you really want to go to one place that has poverty, India still has more than all of sub-Saharan Africa.
But that won't go to India now because people see the Bollywood and high tech and other.
So there's a distraction. So I agree on that. And roughly half of all children today are undernourished today.
Wow.
And no doubt the children that she saw on the hips of those mothers are part of that group. And so the question is, I think there's an explanation, there's a problem that reflects, which is India is doing the market capitalism thing and the democracy thing without the idea with which the West embarked on those things, which is the West, in a way, first came to the idea of universal human dignity, a kind of unmediated relationship between man and God, etc., that put the individual with certain entitlements at the center of the world, and then built capitalism on that, the sovereign individual in the marketplace, then built democracy on that, the sovereign individual voting. India has, in a way, borrowed the idea of democracy and now borrowed the idea of capitalism without coming to a societal consensus on the basic idea of universal human dignity. All men and women are created equal. It's hard to get that sentence out of Indians still if you push people. And that's why you see a lot of this. Now, in terms of the economic question that the caller raised, there's no question, for all of Ronald Reagan's kind of the hatred of the phrase trickle-down, there's no question, regardless of your kind of ideological affiliation, that a lot of the growth in India is trickling down. You go to malls in India, and you see these people who are working in the malls, the clerks in the malls. You can tell from their bodies that they were born into that half of India that is malnourished. Their bodies, they're the same height as me, but they're maybe 30% less body weight.
Right.
But now they're working in a mall, and they're actually making a lot more money than their parents could have dreamed of making. And they are on the upswing. And there are actually millions of people like this. And so even if you're concerned for what's happening, you have to acknowledge that there are large numbers of Indians who are in transition. But I think the concern is there's a lot more Indians who are not going to get a job in a mall. And the question is, what do you do with them? And how do you end up, you know, how do you not end up with, I think, what someone has called, you know, kind of California within sub-Saharan Africa as the shape of the Indian economy, this kind of island of prosperity within a wasteland? How do you connect the two? And I think my own sense is that if you had to do one thing, education is the bridge between the two. And yet it is one of the most tightly restricted, most unchanged sectors of Indian life. The government makes it impossible for the most well-meaning people to do anything in this sphere. And perhaps...
Why?
because it's a sensitive area. You don't want private profiteers coming in and miseducating people and trying to cut revenue, you know, I mean, so cut costs rather. So it is an area where historically all countries, including this country, are very selective about who is allowed to get into the business of educating people. But in a country like India, you're probably not going to solve this problem through government alone. And you probably need to open it up to some amount of private initiative, NGOs, whatever.
Here's a comment online from Vinay Bhatt. Says, private greed is being legitimized at the cost of human rights and people's rights. They're that concerned that, you know, this could just live on top of a mass of impoverished Indians who aren't invited into the party ultimately.
I think that's right, but I also think I encounter a lot of readers who kind of come with these very fixed ideological things that either India is becoming this wonderful place or it's, you know, full of greed and corruption. Mm-hmm. The truth is both, and I tend to avoid these kind of sweeping things that are all one or all the other. I mean, I met a young man who I write about in the book called Ravindra in the middle of nowhere in India in a small village called Bhiwapur. And this guy, like a lot of other people, had figured out a way, without the government helping him, without big companies helping him, to pull himself up. Yeah. And he self-educated himself. He took electrician's classes, English classes, computer classes, and pulled himself up. And he got a job one day at a travel agency. And this kind of tells you the dynamic of the new India. He said, this job was amazing for me. Because not because of the money, not because of the commissions I got selling these travel packages, but because the kind of people who come into a travel agency were people much better born than him.
They didn't live in huts.
They were from cities. They had $2,000 to spend on a vacation package. And he said, I just watched them day in and day out. I looked at how they dressed,
mannerism.
How they talked, what kind of cars they drove, what kind of sunglasses they wore. He called them goggles. And he just memorized everything about them and pulled himself up, became like them, and then had the insight. And this was the turning point in his story, that he was not alone, that although he was extraordinary, he was profoundly ordinary in this new India, that there are actually millions of people like him with that ambition. So he moved. He had read Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People 28 times.
Yeah, amazing.
Moved back to this little town where he was living originally. And became the Dale Carnegie for the town and now helps hundreds and hundreds of people every year learn English, learn roller skating, learn communication skills, whatever it is that'll get them out of their station in life. And so it's those kinds of things that suggest very clearly to me movement, even on this very dim picture.
Eating away at old constraints right there. Let's get a call from Irfan, calling from Boston. Irfan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom, peace be upon you. How are you doing?
Very well. Peace be upon you as well.
Hey, so my name is Irfan, and I was born in a Muslim family in India. I was raised in India. And at the age of 16, there was actually an open interview for Air Force School, and I think this would fit in with Anand's story pretty well. And I traveled about 8 hours, went in for an interview, and there were about 20,000 kids showed up.
Wow.
To get enrolled in Air Force school.
Okay, Air Force, as in military, okay.
Yes, so at the end of the day, they told us that they will take 20 guys. And we stayed there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I passed all the exams. I made it to 300 kids. I was standing in line. Officer comes around, and he tells me, that, why don't you come into my office and come and talk to me? And he told me, I walked into the office. I sat down. Politely, he told me, you have been selected. You will make it to this school. We just need 500,000 rupees from your dad.
Was that a bribe?
You got it.
How much? How big a deal is 500,000 rupees?
Which is impossible even now in day and age. I'm talking about 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And
thousands of dollars.
I called my dad.
Yeah.
My dad told me, there is no way I can afford this. You need to come back. We do not want to enroll you in that school.
Wow. Wow. So, what lesson did you take from that? Yeah.
The basic problem is nepotism. On that night, the guy told me that out of 20 kids, the 12 kids are politicians' sons, daughters, nieces, and nephews.
Wow.
So this is a huge problem. I think the blaming on government everything is, I think, not a right answer. I feel like that the internally nepotism and corruption is eating India up.
Will India's growth outpace nepotism and corruption? Who wins the race? The sort of good development or the corruption, Irfan?
I feel like young people like me who always had an aspiration, like that example, the guy read Dale Carnegie. I read Dale Carnegie in my local language. I taught myself English from nothing.
Yeah.
I was at, like, right now, my parents are in Zambia, and they left India at age of 16, and they told us, you will educate yourself, and you will study by yourself. My brother was 14, I was 17, and we went to college, we were in boarding school, and we had to make it ourselves.
Irfan, I could spend an hour just with your story. It's fantastic, and double peace be upon you, my friend. Thanks for that call, Anand. Our time is short. We've just got a minute. What can we take from that story? It sounds like, oh my gosh, the deck is stacked here.
I think
the decks are stacked in many countries. I don't mean to, we don't live in a glass house in this country.
There are two ways to interpret that story. I think the way that Irfan's interpreting it, and I sympathize with that interpretation, is emphasizing the three guys in the house preventing the 20,000 people from getting in. Another way to interpret the story is, who are those 20,000 people? That's a lot of people. And
aspiring
in my experience,
young men in this case.
And in my experience, the values of those 20,000 people are very good values. They tend to be a lot. There are a lot of people in positions of privilege that they've clung to for a while in India who have those terrible nepotistic values. But the values of those 20,000 people make me very hopeful in India. And at some point, there will be so many of them. And India is changing to accommodate the sentiments and mores of that dynamic, aspiring 20,000 in line.
Anand Giridharadas, this conversation maybe will never be over in our lifetimes between the United States and India. You're a great contributor to it. The new book is India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.